I don't even know how much I knew Mike. I don't think I met him a couple of times, but I didn't know him that well. It's not like we see each other. We're just acquaintances, really. and I knew of his tape artwork. And it wasn't him that cued me into it. It was, and I don't even remember who it was. It might have been Jay Critchley, an artist from the Cape that does a lot of installation stuff and recently did an underground Providence project. Mm-hmm. And we wandered over. He somehow knew how to get in down by the railroad tracks. And I went down and was amazed. Absolutely loved it. It's almost kind of like, I guess it might fall in the category of kind of interventionist kind of art, you know, where certain things that we take for granted, whether it be the built environment or it be the habits of people within that environment, and artists somehow or another sort of intervening on those patterns, whether those patterns be built or those patterns be habitual behavior by humans. And in my mind, it's a way that artists get people to sort of become conscious of their environments and sort of be conscious of, and it kind of twicks the senses, both the mind, the imagination, and the senses, so that we become aware again in the moment, you know, where, you know, most people just are really, really very habitual and often don't hear or see or smell in the process because their mind is preoccupied and they're in the habit of getting from one place to the next. And even the environments that we work and live in, we stop seeing them. I mean, you know, it's so typical when people go to another city or another place and, you know, you find yourself looking up and looking down and looking, you know, mm-hmm. in the way we experience, whether it be a landscape or architecture, when we're taking out of the environments that we live in or that we're most familiar with, and what an exhilarating experience it is, you know. And then, and interestingly enough, how quickly, within a few days, like sometimes when I'm in another city for a conference or something like that, and realize, you know, by the third, fourth, or fifth day, you're already starting to take things for granted, and the environment starts to feel familiar in ways that where you stop being surprised or exhilarated in some way, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot about what Mike does in general, his work, you know? And that space in particular was, here's a sewer, mm-hmm, a fairly large space, who would have ever known. It brings the observer into a space they would never, ever, ever consider going to. And I think, we have like the gallery, you know, gallery exhibits would be artists show their work traditionally, or even in museums, and these sort of spaces that are defined and dedicated for the exhibition of art are, there's a set of expectations and a set of conditioned responses. It's like you go in, you look at the artwork for 5 minutes, maybe, you drink your wine and your cheese and you leave, or you go in and you have a kind of private experience, but it's pretty safe and it has how, you know, it certainly stimulates the mind, the imagination, but it's in a contained set of expectations and conditioned responses. Mm-hmm. So you can go in, have the experience, leave the gallery, and almost leave it there. So what these sort of, just to categorize again, because our need is to sort of consume things and define them so we can get comfortable and we can move on. We don't have to think too much about it. So I'm going to do the same thing by talking about as interventionist artists as a form of category. And what they do is they allow art to sort of have a different kind of life outside of the gallery or the museum, placing it in a certain context that is not what's expected. So I think that changes everything. I think that changes the way we see it, the way we respond to it, the impact that it has on us, the way we view the space that it's in. And we just did a piece here. We went on a little walking tour. We have an artist that's in residence that did these little sound installations in spaces that are barely audible. Probably nobody is going to know that they're even there. And we took a tour around. And there's something conceptually really kind of beautiful about it. And also the fact that we were tuning our ears in when we were listening with all the ambiance out around them, the natural noises of the city. We were really tuning our ears in to hear these things. And it sort of, everything started to become more vivid. All of the sounds around it started to become more vivid. In fact, Lucy in our office, they were saying, I think there's more ambient sound outside today. I said, do you think that's maybe because you're listening differently? Mm-hmm. You know, so you sort of, you're retuning your senses as a result of this sort of
change in environment.
Yeah, the change in environment and the way the artwork is forcing you to experience that environment and mm-hmm. and focus your senses and focus your attention in ways that you ordinarily would not be doing. Mm-hmm. And some way or another, what I want to believe is that that has some indelible impact, that when you walk away from that, that you're, for some period of time, and also your recall of the ability to tune in has been impacted, and that you may be more sensitive for some period of time or capable of tuning in and tuning out in a more capable way. It's like an exercise, you know, you're working on mm-hmm. Working on this kind of stuff. And also I think throughout history, artists have had this sort of assumed this responsibility of, and maybe it's a human thing, of getting people and the viewer to experience things differently, to value things differently in the moment, and have always had to sort of create ways to do that, because it doesn't take long for the general population to assimilate and consume a way of doing things. I'll give you an interventionist example that I think is kind of interesting. I used to be involved in a group called Meatballs Fluxus. And we used to do these performances in a performance space, but we also used to do what we call meatball hits. And one time, Hemingway's, a popular restaurant here in the city, mm-hmm. It was really packed on a Friday night. We had an accomplice, and they opened a back door, and we came in all dressed in black with white face, and we blew horns all on cue, blasted horns, and then ran out the door. And it was a dead, dead silence when we hit the horns. Now, this was a completely animated, loud environment. And my wife and her sister were sitting at the bar to sort of kind of record the reactions. And someone at the bar said, immediately turns and says, oh, I hear they're doing this at all the restaurants. So it's like a reaction to sort of understand, mm-hmm. to consume, to take ownership of, because you have to like sort of, like the human instinct is to, well, let me figure this out, let me understand this. Don't let this be mysterious, God mm-hmm. forbid, because it's too threatening, mm-hmm. you know, it's too threatening. So our mind immediately wants to wrap its arms around it, contain it, box it in, put it on a shelf, and then move on to something. So I think artists, historically, that's what they've done. In architects, there's an art and design school in Toronto. You know that art building that's suspended, that's hanging mm-hmm. like a big box mm-hmm. in the air?
I've seen pictures, I've never been in.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I haven't been inside it, but as soon as you turn the corner of that block, and there's a lot of really fairly traditional, almost, I don't know, not classical, but fairly traditional architecture on that street. Mm-hmm. And then there's this giant suspended box mm-hmm. in primary colors that seems to defy logic the way it's cantilevered out. And it's massive, and I can't imagine that there isn't a day go by that anybody passes that building that at some level mm-hmm. it doesn't entertain and stimulate and sort of jog them out of their routine. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was there 4 or 5 days one time and must have passed that building 3 or 4 times, and it wasn't, now again, that's only a week, but it always sort of had that kind of response to me. It kind of awakened me, sort of, again, whoa, forgot that building was there, you know, and made me more conscious of my environment, you know. So, and I don't know, artists, I'm not sure of who else does that. I mean, I think that there are different ways that people try to get us to appreciate the moment, and I mean, it's kind of a Zen thing in a way, you know, to sort of really be where you are when in the moment, and to be able to appreciate all of what's happening in the instant. But the artists take it on almost as a it's a cause, you know. It's almost almost militant about their responsibility towards doing that. Certainly not all artists, but I think every artist and what they make, if they're making a two-dimensional piece that's going to show in a traditional gallery, in some way or another, are hoping that there's going to be some exchange between the viewer. The idea of a piece of art that exists that doesn't have an audience is an absurdity to me. And even when there are conceptual pieces created that are not exhibited, that are just in thought, they're publicized in some way. You know, they're promoted, whether it be underground or it be strategically in some sort of marketed way. So there's always the assumption of an audience, I think, when an artist is creating or an architect is creating. The unfortunate thing with things like architecture is that they're generally, they're usually very limited by cost and the client. So it's a struggle to make art as an architect generally, unless you're making it in Dubai or something now, where money is not an issue, and they're looking for that kind of art in their architecture. So, I mean, Michael's piece also, there was the sort of memory component of it. So there was a whole nother layer, besides the fact that he repurposed the space. There was also the more traditional sort of traditional layer of intent, which was that it was autobiographical. It was about exiting one life and entering another. It was about how to memorialize his history, but also look at it as burying it as being part of the past. And that he was onto something else. So there were these other more traditional kinds of intentions and layers to it, of meaning, layers of meaning. And maybe that becomes even more poignant when it's, again, not in a place you would expect it to be. You know, that there's something more startling about it in a way, and something almost more somber about it, that it was in a sewer, that he was putting his past to bed, so to speak, or burying it in a coffin or whatever. I forget all the pieces of it, but I'm pretty good, right? And that just as an example of that, I haven't thought of that piece probably in 5 years, haven't even considered it, but the fact that they were bringing it about, and the fact that that's such a narrative is still present in my mind. There are not many experiences in my life that I had 5 years ago that I can string a narrative together that way. So the symbolism was powerful, powerful enough that I could sort of retrace the story, you know. So much of it seems related to senses, you know, and how, you know, we have these senses and we're seeing, like, I'm just looking at you and in relationship to this environment here. This environment is so damn familiar with me, to me already. I've only been in this building for a year, and it doesn't, there are few surprises, you know. And what happens to, where do you live when everything that you're experiencing is almost taken for granted or are so familiar. Where do you live? What is the living experience that you're having in that kind of setting? Now, I think a lot takes place in the mind, and maybe in some ways it frees up. It's because you feel things are familiar and you're safe. That's another thing that we didn't talk about, how this kind of intervention stuff, it sort of rattles that security. You know, all of a sudden things are not as you would expect them to be. And it's people go on a roller coaster, it's, you know. But again, you go, you pay the price, you see the roller coaster, you hear people screaming, so you know exactly what you're in for, you know, and you make this choice. You know, when artists are intervening, you're not aware that this thing is going to happen, you know. So in some ways, the security and safety of the familiar and the habitual allow me to, when I'm walking down the street, not necessarily to be negotiating my environment, but be spending time in my mind, mm-hmm. right? Whereas if I go to an unfamiliar city, I'm negotiating my environment, and that's the primary thing that I'm aware of, is the environment that I'm in. And the kind of thoughts that I'm having are more around the kind of problem solving, recording, trying to make it familiar, so that if I have to go from this place again, I'll understand the easiest and most efficient way to get there. So I'm trying to record landmarks, I'm trying to familiarize myself, I'm trying to code the environment, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. If that's all in place, then I would assume that it's freeing you to spend more, hopefully some more time in your mind.
I'm around the corner, but
that could be mundane, you know, because even that sort of is within the confines of some routine. You know, you're walking from this place to this place, but that's because you're going to work, or you're mm-hmm. going mm-hmm. to a class, or you're going with all of which you have certain expectations, and you either are prepared for or not prepared for, you know. None of that happens when something is unfamiliar, and it's a bit of a shock, you know. And I think it's so, I don't know. And also, there's the side of it, like what Mike's piece in the bay in the sewer was, the being in on something,
yeah,
like, you know,
that kind of secret society.
That's right. That there's a secret thing. That there's something. And for the longest time after that, I would reflect back on it. Like in my ordinary day, thinking like there's this thing going on that I'm aware of that the vast majority of people in the state of Rhode Island don't know exists, mm-hmm. that this work of art is, you know. I had a similar feeling, and I was wondering, this is funny too. I was actually wondering if Michael was responsible for it. I was canoeing up the river, and it was a pretty steep, overgrown bank, and there was actually a structure built in there as if somebody was sleeping or hanging in the space. And I don't know if it looked a little bit too elaborate to be a homeless person, but it may have been. But this is somebody had created a space within the bushes and trees coming down into the river where it's not very appealing or very accessible. The only way you would discover it is if you were on the water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I started to think of Mike.
Yeah,
I said,
I
this
know.
Has got to be another Mike.
He didn't mention that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he didn't mention the one in the mall either.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the one in the sewer,
yeah.
You know. So I started thinking it was him. Now, any sort of space that's created, I'm going to be thinking that somehow or another he's responsible.
Yeah.
You know? But
he told me one piece that just got buried by the fruit and produce warehouse, the tunnels to the cold storage, those two buildings. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The big, long building that got demolished
yes,
recently.
Yes,
And the building across the street was the refrigeration for it, and there were tunnels underneath that would keep all the stuff cool.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's a really cool structure, but I'm gone now. But in one of those tunnels, he was saying that he built this he cast a lot of his friends' faces in these kind of horrific screams and covered a wall with them just because he thought it would be the perfect thing.
Oh,
that's
my
what
God.
The people are looking for. You know, when they're exploring.
Yeah, they want. They,
that's what
yeah,
they want.
They're looking
you know?
To be horrified.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Freaked out,
or
a
to,
rat
to
run from
to,
a corner.
Or to find something to like form a narrative around.
That's
serious.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't it true? They are. Everybody's looking for a story. That's true. That's really, really interesting. How many old spaces, because we've had so much to do with buildings and things like that, and going into old buildings, how many old buildings have I gone into in my life where some you're looking for artifacts, you're looking to know what happened here, you're looking for the mystery and also the human side, the human connection to it, like this is a place that people worked for 100 years, and what kinds of stories, what kinds of immigrants, what kind of who cut their finger off on that machine or what, you know, and you're looking for some evidence, something to spark.
And in something like the tunnel, I mean, just the evidence of human contact with that space.
Yeah, yep, exactly.
It's really powerful.
Yeah, it makes me think that in some ways our imagination is a kind of a living thing that wants to be fed, that has its own need to be fed and stimulated, that it's and you know, you wonder about people who get Alzheimer's or dementia, and you wonder about how people age, because you know, like they say that music is something they always remember, no matter how bad they are, they can get a sit on a piano and play a tune even though they have Alzheimer's, you know, and I wonder about how productive and how it leads to a longer and more quality life, the more you provoke your imagination as a sort of a routine, as a habit, that's the type of person in the way that you live your life, that you're always looking for that kind of adventure and that kind of stimulation, and how, what that does to the whole human being as the human being is growing older and evolving in time. And I think of it because, you know, I'm 58 years old now, so I'm thinking about these things. You know, there's certainly a lot of people that I've known and a lot of my friends that have died already. And I not only want to live old, but I want to live a quality life, you know. And I already see things happening with my memory. And I almost feel like because of a lot of the life challenges of like having a partner, where I'm going to live, these kinds of things, have been resolved for me, even my mission, so to speak, that it almost leaves more room to be stimulated. Like, it doesn't threaten me, you know? There were times, like, in my a former life, when I was married, living in the suburbs, had two cars and a straight job, where I would go to an exhibit or see artwork that would provoke me and it would be so stimulating. And I almost didn't want it. It made me sad because I wanted more of it. And my life wouldn't allow it. My life, there was no room for it, for my imagination to run wild. What would that threatened the whole routine, the whole security of my life. That might mean I might not want to go to my straight job tomorrow morning.
What were you doing?
You know? At the time, for the most of the time, I ran a printing press in a bank. The bank had its own print shop where a lot of the forms and things like that, we printed letterheads and cards for the, you know, we did all the printing for that stuff. So I ran a printing press most of that time. I went, not the whole time, but most of that time. You know, but it was a routine that, you know, 40 hours a week, and I can't even imagine starting to feel suicidal. But if I had an incredibly inspired piece of artwork, I went and saw an incredibly inspired performance, I would get sad because I wanted more of that in my life, you know? So I think in some ways, a heightened way of living, which again, I think is what Michael's piece's work is about, is sort of heighten our sort of experiences and call attention to things that we easily take for granted. That mall, that they would spend $400 million on a mall and that there would be so many cubic feet that was unaccounted for. How can you spend $400 million, the inefficiency of that, How could you spend $400 million on a space and have so many cubic feet unaccounted for? Like it doesn't have any value within the context of that. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a hole, you know? It's a weird thing, you know? And that there could be, of course, then the underground component of it, you know, mm-hmm. living in this space while all this other activity is going on. And then periodically, by choice, coming out of there and into that space and interacting with that space and then receding mm-hmm. back in, you know? Beautiful imagery, mm-hmm. you know? But